Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Dr. Will Tuttle, and he will be coming on talking to us about his book, The World Peace Diet, and I'll tell you more about all the wonderful things he's involved with in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in the news and around town, and also share my weekly recipe with you. And of course, the news is not hard to come upon these days. I mean, everybody's talking about the coronavirus and the impact that that's having on everybody. And it is real. It is really hitting home as everything's been closed down. We're all quarantined to stay home and to not go out except for, you know, to the store when we need to. They're even making special hours in the morning for people 60 and over. And I find it very shocking that I happen to fall into that group, because I don't think of myself as the elderly at all, but I do fall into that group. But I've yet to get up that early to go do it. So I am still, you know, working off the food that I have in my refrigerator. And as I joke with my husband, I think we could eat probably for a month in this house without ever leaving. But since I do want fresh vegetables and it's not the season for my garden, I do need to venture out for that. But there's a lot of things that, you know, that are going on that are really scary, but there's also things that are really beautiful that we're able to see as a little bit of a silver lining. I went to the park the other day and I saw so families, you know, mothers and fathers with their children and friends just taking walks. And that's something that I haven't seen very often. I mean, I'll go to that park often, and very often there's just a few cars in the parking lot. And this time the parking lot was just packed. And, you know, that's really a nice thing. And also time to just go inward a little bit and to slow down with all our events and take the time to read and to contemplate and to meditate a little more and to listen to music and read books, things that very often we put on the back burner that we now might have some time to do. As of this recording, you know, the Congress was still battling the rescue bill that we need to pass. The Senate's version is, you know, supporting big corporations a lot more than the House's bill. And the House is really looking to make the bill protective of people with paid sick leave and family leave and emergency cash assistance and a home guarantee so that people don't lose their homes if they can't make their rent, and a ban to make sure that utilities don't cut them off if they can't make their bills. You know, things to really look at for the small guy, because the small guy is the one that usually is impacted by these crises. He's much more so than those that are more well off, who have savings, who can fall back on some of their fortunate positions in society, where those that are really hourly wage earners that have lost their jobs are really screwed. And this is really scary for those people. And so we need a bill, and we need our Congress to really step up to the plate to help protect those people. I also wanted to share with you, and I shared this week in my newsletter, two resource guides. One is a resource guide just to ways to protect yourself that was put out by Green Beats, which is a nonprofit that I interviewed a few weeks ago. And this is just a resource guide that, you know, helps you with social distancing and keeping things clean and ways to cook and get food and all that stuff. The other one is actually for parents who now find themselves as homeschool teachers and how to really do it and how to manage it. You know, so many schools are trying to quickly put together a curriculum online, but that only holds a student's attention for so long. And the days are long when they're home and not getting together with friends and no play dates and parks are closed. And, you know, if you have a playground in your own backyard, great. But if you don't, you know, your kids are in the house or outside just with their own ball, whatever. If you live in an apartment building, you're really inside. There's nowhere to go. So this is a Ayurveda Montessori school guide that really I thought was so beautiful because it really brings a rhythm into your school day. You know, it starts by, you know, getting up in the morning and just, you know, establishing a daily rhythm with maybe a little bit of free play. Then you eat breakfast, then maybe journaling, meditation, you get dressed, then give the kids some work to do around the house so that they feel like they're a participant, whether it's helping to make breakfast or to prepare lunch, you know, give them some outside time if you can. Even if you do live in an apartment, you can take them out to just for a walk to get a little fresh air. Maybe do some yoga, give them some lunch, some silent reading time or quiet time after lunch. And then, of course, they have a lot of energy. They need to move. So give them some dance movements and another work cycle so that, again, they are participating in the family. You know, maybe a movie with a snack. You know, as a Waldorf teacher and someone who really encouraged as little screen time as possible for young kids, it's really a challenge right now, especially with learning being put up online. How do you limit screen time when that's all you have? So these are one of those times where exceptions step into place and you have to make some room for exceptions and screen time might come into play. So anyway, I just thought it was a great guide that I just wanted to share with you. So you can find that in my newsletter. And then ways that you can also take action, you know, as I was saying before, the House and Senate are fighting over this $2 trillion coronavirus rescue bill. You know, but let them know what we want to see in it. Let them know that we want to see, you know, protection for the small guy, not just bailing out the airplanes and airlines and the big corporations. They're gonna come back. It's the small guy that's really gonna be challenged from this. So that's where we need to step up to the plate. And then, you know, some of the beautiful things that have been coming out of this, you know, people playing music out on their fire escapes and, you know, digital coming together, whether it's Google Hangouts or we did a Zoom session with my kids the other day. It was my son's birthday and we couldn't be together. And that was heartbreaking, but we all hung out for an hour on the internet together. And that was really, really satisfying. So check out some of those new platforms that enable that, whether it's Google Hang or Zoom, they're all there for us. And, you know, they're coming at a really good time. This is also a great time to cook. This is a great time to experiment with some of those recipes that you wanted to, you know, try that you've never tried before. I have a very basic recipe that I made a few weeks ago at the school for Meatless Monday. And this recipe is just so delicious. And yet at the last minute when I wasn't there, the power ups decided that kids might not like beans. So they left the beans out of the recipe and put them on the side. And then of course the kids don't take them. And then the recipe does not have the protein that it's supposed to have in it to meet the nutritional standards for the school lunch program. But anyway, this recipe of sautéed broccoli with cherry tomatoes and cannellini beans in garlic and oil over whole wheat penne was just delicious. And you can put it over quinoa pasta or brown rice pasta, whatever pasta you like will work in this recipe. And you're going to cook the pasta, you know, according to the directions. Of course, you want to cook it al dente and reserve some of the water for this recipe. You're going to need one onion, two heads of broccoli. My heads were small heads. That's why I said two, but one large head would be fine as well. You're going to cut those into florets, one pint of cherry tomatoes that are cut in half, a half a cup of olive oil, a quarter cup of white wine, 3 tablespoons of minced garlic cloves, 1 can of cannelloni beans, 1 teaspoon oregano and 1 teaspoon of basil, salt and pepper to taste, red pepper flakes if you like a little bit of spice to your dish, and a quarter cup of chopped parsley. So you're going to start in a large pan or wok. You're going to saute the onions in the olive oil with half of the garlic. And you're going to cook those until translucent. Then you're going to add the broccoli and the remaining garlic and cook that until the broccoli starts to soften. Then add the cherry tomatoes, the beans, the white wine, and the basil and oregano. And let that cook down for just a few minutes, 5-10 minutes, until the cherry tomatoes are soft and the beans are hot and have absorbed some of the flavor. Then add all of the pasta to the wok, along with 1/4 cup of the pasta cooking water, and mix that well and adjust the seasonings to your taste, adding a little more salt or pepper, a little more oregano if you'd like, and red pepper flakes if you'd like that. And then you're going to garnish it with the fresh parsley, mix that up, and that is it. Couldn't be easier. I served it with some fresh garlic bread and a wonderful salad, and that was it. And as I said, this was a great meal for Meatless Monday at the school. And I was a little disappointed that they chose to leave the beans out, because the beans really make it. And, you know, this is it's a common thing for grown-ups sometimes to think, oh, kids won't like that, and then kind of deciding for them rather than encouraging them to try it and giving it to them. You know, I've done lots of food demos at farmers markets, and so often the parents, you know, I hear parents or grandparents saying to the kids, oh, you won't like that. And the kids going, please, I want to try. And the kids try it and love it. So we need to really model openness for our children and let them give it a try. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Dr. Will Tuttle. His writings, presentations, and music focus on compassion, creativity, intuition, and the intersection of social justice, animal liberation, and environmental, health, spiritual, and peace issues. He's a visionary speaker, educator, author, and musician. He was a former Zen monk and has a PhD from UC Berkeley, and he's been a vegan since 1980. His book, The World Peace Diet, offers an expanded understanding of our culture and our health. It's been called one of the most important books of the 21st century, the foundation of a new society honoring the interconnection of life. The World Peace Diet is one of the first books to make explicit the hidden connections between our culture, our food, the source of our broad range of problems, and the way to a positive transformation in our individual and collective lives. He's the editor of Circles of Compassion and Buddhism and Veganism, and he's also the author of Your Inner Islands and many other books. He's the recipient of the Courage of Conscience Award and the Empty Cages Prize. He has appeared in many radio, television, print, and online interviews, as well as the documentary film Cowspiracy, which Slow Food showed a few years back, and Prayer for Companion, and some other films as well. And I'm so excited to have him join us, especially during this time of home quarantine, where it's a great opportunity for us to try some new foods and make some new choices in our lives. So I hope you all welcome me. Help welcome Will to the show. Will, are you with me?
Yes, I sure am. Thanks so much, Bhavani. And my mouth is watering after hearing those delicious recipes you were sharing. Sounds like good food. Yeah.
I'm telling you, I have such a problem cooking for just two people. It's not in my DNA. I always cook for a lot of people. And, you know, every night I'm cooking and the leftovers are piling up. I think I'm going to have to start a delivery
service. All these leftovers.
Right.
Great.
So, let's talk about your book, The World Peace Diet, and, you know, and the work that you're doing. Can you share with us what you would say is the main message of your books and your lifelong work?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important, especially now, as you were saying, we're sort of in the grips of this panic and the pandemic. And the World Peace Diet is a book that really, I think, endeavors to go to the very roots of the problems that we're facing in our society and the underlying causes, the hidden causes of the dilemmas that we're facing, and how we can co-create together a world where peace and freedom and justice and equality and radiant health and environmental sanity and so forth are actually possible. And so the underlying idea is the devastating impact of animal agriculture on our society, on the earth, on our health, not just our physical health, but our psychological, spiritual health, our social and cultural health also. And the enormous benefit, actually, of questioning the official narratives in our society that promote the domination and exploitation of non-human animals, of each other, of ecosystems, of women also, and to see that essentially animal agriculture is not just an activity that is, has profoundly harmful effects on our physical health and our psychological health and our spiritual health and our cultural health and our environmental health. It's attacking all of those, basically. We don't realize it, I don't think, but at a deeper level, that animal agriculture is actually an entire worldview that is in all of us. Even if we're vegans, like I've been a vegan now for 40 years, but I still know that the underlying perspective of animal agriculture is something I'm still working with to in a sense to clean out of my system, because it's a way of seeing the world that's based on an adversarial domination separation perspective, that we're in a world where there's all these forces that we have to fight against, and that we have to dominate and exploit others in order to survive. You know, this animal agriculture is a way of getting food that's based on harming others, rather than on celebrating the abundance of food that we would do in a plant-based world. So the World Peace Diet goes into this historically and anthropologically to understand how our culture evolved to be the way it is, and how all of us are wounded by being born into a society that's organized at its living core around killing literally hundreds of millions, actually even billions when we talk about and include marine animals. It's actually billions every day of animals are being killed. And so this is a massive industrialized killing machine that we're most of us are participating in if we're eating animal foods or buying leather and wool and silk and or going to entertainment and or even many products that are tested on animals and so forth. So the whole idea is to try to live a life that's based on respect and kindness for all expressions of life, not just other human beings, but all living beings. And that since we're failing at doing that on a massive scale, we're sowing the seeds of disease and devastation and chaos in our own lives, like we're inflicting on animals. And as I keep saying in the World Peace Diet, there's something that I refer to as the boomerang effect. Whatever we sow, so shall we reap. So if we're sowing seeds of devastation and harm and terror and fear and pain and despair and panic in billions of animals every single day, you know, how are we expecting to not have the same thing happen to us? You know, it's going to happen to us. It is happening to us. We have terrorism and war, and we have a pandemic. But the underlying idea is this is a product.
The pandemic comes from animals.
Right.
Right. And the pandemic comes from animals.
Yeah, there's many levels that this operates on. It operates, like you say, on many levels, sort of the physical level. Perhaps, you know, we can say that there's a what's called a zoonotic dimension of disease, which is basically that, you know, there's lots of viruses and bacteria and fungus and other, you know, organisms and so forth that we normally wouldn't be exposed to because we're not normally playing around with wild animals and so forth. But the thing is, today we have systems of agriculture that are so perverse that we have animals living in hyper-confined situations where they're just crammed together in filth and misery with being, there's over 10,000 different drugs and hormones that are used to try to keep these animals alive or to push them to give more milk, to give more eggs. 90% in the United States of all antibiotics are administered to animals to keep them alive and to fatten them up, because it also helps to fatten them. So we're just creating through the massive overuse of antibiotics, for example, all kinds of antibiotic resistant bacteria, which is a huge issue, and then hyper confining animals in various ways. And having them together in ways that they never would be naturally. And then, so there's lots of ways that we're creating this on the physical level. But I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. And that's the tiny tip of the iceberg. We should look deeper and realize that our whole orientation towards nature and towards each other and towards animals is not healthy. It's based on domination and fear, because the food is that based on domination and fear. And food is our most intimate connection with nature, with animals, and with our society. And anthropologists have talked about this for a long time. Every anthropologist understands basically, and the underlying idea is that every society transmits its values from generation to generation. That's what societies do. You know, whether it's a small tribe in the Amazon or a large, you know, like our culture today, we have rituals. Every culture has rituals that embody and transmit the values and attitudes and norms and mores of that culture. And the primary ritual in every society are meals. There's nothing more powerful than sitting down and eating food. This is how we connect with nature and with each other. And so if we look deeply at what kind of attitudes we're transmitting when we're eating meat, dairy products, and eggs, we'll see very clearly that we're transmitting values, and we're embodying values and reinforcing values that are not in our best interest. And animal agriculture from the very beginning, for example, is very different from plant agriculture. I think it's very important to understand that plant agriculture from the beginning was mainly done by women. It was done by men and women, but it was especially women who would plant seeds and who would work with nature and with the harmony of nature and with the natural abundance. I mean, this wonderful, miraculous, beautiful gift that we do it all the time. We plant a seed and the seed gives fruit. I mean, a tree comes forth and hundreds and thousands of or tens of thousands of fruits will come from the tree, or tomatoes, or squashes, or whatever it is. Abundance, this wonderful abundance. So there's this natural sense of gratitude, of working with the harmony and the cycles of nature, the natural abundance of nature, and with the cycles of the seasons and of the moon and so forth. Whereas animal agriculture, when it was first started about 10,000 years ago, was always men's work. It was nothing women did. It was men's work, and it required them to do work that brought out the worst in them. They had to become hard and tough and disconnected from their natural sensitivity and kindness and respect and the natural respect we have for other expressions of life, and to dominate and exploit other beings and to sexually abuse them, to impregnate them against their will. Because the whole idea with animal agriculture at the core really is to breed these animals. You know, this is something that I think is not really well understood in our society, that we have with animal agriculture a threefold process. Number one, the most obvious one, of course, is you're confining them, right? They can't move. They're in cages, or they're in prisons of some kind. They're in some kind of fences where they can't get out. That's not what they want. They hate that. They've always been resisting that. They don't want to be confined. They don't want to be killed. They don't want to have their babies stolen, their milk stolen, their eggs stolen, everything stolen, their purpose is stolen. They've always resisted. We've always done the same thing. We've always overpowered them with sheer physical force and technological force, and used electric guards and hormones and drugs, and we have all kinds of systems in place now, high-tech systems, so that it's all invisible. We don't see it. These animals are now confined in stinking sheds very often by the thousands or even tens of thousands. We don't see it. It's sort of out of sight and out of mind. So we don't realize that we are a herding culture. We are a culture that's organized at its core around imprisoning and killing millions of animals every day, land animals, and billions every day when we include marine animals. And so these are the three aspects of animal agriculture: are confining them and then killing them. But you couldn't have either one of those without breeding them. And so breeding is really the essential aspect of the whole thing. You have to impregnate these animals against their will and steal their babies and kill their babies, and then re-impregnate them and do the same thing, kill their babies again, and then re-impregnate them again and kill their babies again and steal everything from them. So it's the most hideous and massive ongoing violence. And we don't just cause this violence as individuals in our society by taking out our wallets and paying for it. That's what causes it. So we're causing it as individuals, but we're not just causing it. Then we turn around and we actually eat this violence. We eat the violence, we feed it to our children. The enormous disease, I mean, these animals are diseased. They're all diseased. They're confined. They're not living their lives the way they would in naturally in nature. And so they're full of disease. And this is well understood. There's cancer, there's all kinds of diseases. And these animals suffer from diseases. They suffer from obesity, for example. I mean, obesity is, I mean, the whole point, actually, it's purposeful obesity. These animals are everything about the way they're treated is to make them as obese as possible because they're sold by the pound. So you want them fat so you get more money. So we have whole armies of our scientists in universities and all over, you know, in our country and all over the world, actually, who are working continuously on ways of breeding animals, on ways of feeding animals, on ways of, you know, lighting systems and drugs, and hormones and all kinds of things with just one thing in mind, to make them as fat as possible, as quickly as possible. So these are the seeds we're sowing continuously to just, you know, make them miserable and fat as possible. And we sow those seeds and we reap an obesity epidemic. You know, we have this, and all the experts say that it's an ongoing epidemic. We have more and more people in our society today who are overweight and who are obese. And the statistics right now say that just by 2030, it'll be over 50% will be actually clinically obese in the United States. So, and then we have, again, on top of that, we have approximately, according to the United Nations, about approximately 30,000 people die every day of hunger. I mean, they die of hunger and starvation, 30,000 every day. We don't talk about that. We're talking about, I mean, this whole pandemic has only killed 14,000 people total in 2 months. We've killed 30,000 every day of starvation. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about the fact that there's so many thousands of people are dying of hunger and starvation, which is completely unnecessary, because every year we grow enough food on this earth to feed many more people than we have. We have about 7.7 billion people. We grow enough every year to feed 10 to 12 billion people. So there's no reason people should be starving, but we have obesity and we have starvation because we have inequality, because we have animal agriculture, because most of the grain, over half the grain that we're growing, in the United States it's about 80% of the grain and legumes that we grow are not fed to people. They're fed to the imprisoned cows and pigs and chickens and imprisoned fishes. You know, eat enormous amounts of grain and soy to fatten up and then be fed. Very often fishes are fed to cows to make them give more milk, or to pigs or to chickens. So we have this whole system. It's an extremely perverse, violent system based on waste and domination of animals, heartless abuse of animals and of starving people. And all of that is covered up. Why isn't the media talking about this? Why don't we hear about this happening? This is something we could actually deal with very effectively if we just knew about it and we put our resources to it and we made it into an emergency. It is an emergency. I mean, it's well understood that animal agriculture and is the driving force behind food shortages, and it's well understood that food shortages are the driving force behind war and conflict in the world, and that war and conflict in the world are the driving forces behind misery and people being displaced and refugees moving and, you know, just a whole cascade of suffering and environmental devastation from war and disease and hunger and starvation driven by animal agriculture. We're cutting down rainforests, even though nobody's talking about it because of the pandemic. We're still cutting down rainforests at 4 acres per second, causing the largest mass extinction of species really in 65 million years. Over 200 species are going extinct every day because of animal agriculture, because we're still eating animal foods. So we have to wake up. I mean, this is the thing we have to understand. We're so concerned about our own plight and so forth, but what are we doing? What seeds are we sowing? And without thinking about it, right, just being completely utterly insulated from the effects of this, because the media is just not talking about it. Because, and I understand this, my father owned a whole chain of newspapers, so I understand very clearly that in the media you only will hear stories in the news that are in the news because the large corporations who are paying for the advertising, that's what they want people to hear. That's what they want people to know about. That's what they want people to understand. So I'm so grateful to you, Bhavani,
even in the circle around, food equity and food shortage issues. I mean, like you were saying, the starvation and obesity are two sides of the same coin, and yet people don't want to really talk about giving up meat because it's they try to avoid that aspect of talking about the food problem and climate change because it's something that so many people are so attached to. But, kids naturally don't want to eat animals. I mean, they grow up, looking at book farm animals and, they love the chickens and they love the cows. And, I remember saying this, a child, do you eat chickens? And they go, no, I don't eat chicken. I said, but don't you eat chicken nuggets? Yeah, but that's different. They don't
make the connection and that's not their fault. It's just the fact that it's covered up, the whole thing is covered up. And that's the problem. We have to realize, I think, that we've all been wounded by this. It's not our fault. I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just saying this is a situation. We're born into a herding culture, and a herding culture naturally has a mentality of domination and exploitation of animals and of nature and a separation between ourselves and the natural world because we're not in harmony with it. We're looking with eyes of how can I kill, how can I own, rather than seeing the beauty that's there. It's men's work that brings out the worst in them, animal agriculture, whereas if we had a more plant-based way of living, which is more based on a sense of harmony and connectedness and nurturing plants and nurturing life, then this is the only future we have. We do not have a future if we continue on this. And this, I think, obviously the pandemic is a direct result of this. And yet it's something that no one is going to see or talk about because we live in a society where we're not even allowed to go there to think of these thoughts. But I think people do on some level intuitively sense this. I think on some level intuitively we realize that we're unhappy when we're disconnected from nature and from the beauty and abundance of the natural world, that they can feed us so easily on a fraction of the land. I mean, that's the great good news I want to celebrate here, really, is that we can feed everyone on this planet on a fraction of the earth. We could allow habitat to come back and rivers and oceans and forests, and we could use a lot less oil and petroleum and be much healthier. This whole thing with the pandemic is it all comes in really down in many ways to the health of our immune system. I mean, having a healthy immune system is really important. And again, eating animal-based foods is a direct attack on our immune system. And we see this very clearly, that people who have pre-existing conditions are much more likely to get sick. I mean, this is everyone understands this, but I'm not afraid of being sick from the pandemic because I have a strong immune system. I've been a vegan for 40 years, and Madeline and I travel. We've been traveling all over the world. I've spoken in over 50 countries. I've been to China many times, to India, all over Southeast Asia, all over Eastern Europe, Western Europe, North and South America, hugging and shaking hands with thousands of people. A lot of them are sick. I never get sick. I have a strong immune system. I mean, if we have a healthy immune system, we can handle things that come our way. I think the real pandemic is the violence of animal agriculture, and then the underlying unwillingness that we have to confront our shadow, underlying unwillingness that we have to confront and deal with and recognize, really, that we've been wounded, that we're being lied to about everything, and that we're being lied to a lot about the food, and to really take responsibility for our own health and take responsibility for our actions. And to move to a plant-based way of eating out of respect for nature, for animals, for hungry people, and for ourselves, for our own organs, and for other people. This is, people are so concerned, which is good, to be respectful of others during this time. Well, if you really want to be respectful to others, then we should definitely be moving to a totally 100% all plant diet, not stabbing animals and eating their secretions which are really toxic anyway. I mean, there's so many different types of toxicity and animal-based foods. I can talk about that, you know, maybe at some point. But just to understand that if we want to just reduce the toxic load that we're ingesting, to move to organic, whole food, plant-based way of eating is a fantastic gift we can give to the world and to ourselves. And it's something each one of us can do. It's just a wonderful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take a couple minute break. When we come back, I want to talk about some things you talk about in your book, like the domination of the feminine, you know, what that really is. And also, you know, I was really fascinated to hear some of the quotes from, you know, old, you know, visionaries from our past, like Leonardo da Vinci and Albert Einstein. I found that fascinating that they were. If you're just joining us, my guest this week is Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet, and we're talking about his book and how one can expand on compassion and love by eating a plant-based diet. So, Will, are you with me?
I sure am. It's great to be here, Bhavani. Thank you.
Great. So, right before the break, I wanted to ask you about the domination of the feminine. You talk about that a lot in your book. Can you explain to my listeners what you mean by that?
Yes, the domination of the feminine is the underlying attitude and orientation of a herding culture, which is based not just on confining and killing animals, but also on impregnating them. And so the underlying problem essentially is that, and this happened, I think, historically in our societies, when gradually we started owning animals as property for food. This started in East, it looks like, according to scientists or anthropologists who study this, in what is today Iraq, around 10,000 years ago, wild sheep, then wild goats, and then later wild cows, and then later other animals gradually were owned as property, and actually owned, and they were wealth. And so this led to the arising, for the first time on planet Earth, of a wealthy elite class who were the rich herders who became known as the kings, who then invented war. The oldest word for war is the ancient Sanskrit word gavya, which means the desire for more cows. And war and slavery. Slavery came right out of war because the whole idea behind the war was to get more wealth, capital. The word capita, where we get our word for capital, capitalism, means head, as in head of sheep and goats and cows. So these proto-capitalist kings, the herders that had large amounts of wealth, which were large flocks of sheep and goats and cows, would try to increase their wealth and increase the land that they would need for these cows and the water that they would need for these cows and sheep and goats. They would go fight in a war to get more land and more slave animals. And whoever lost the war, then gradually the policy began to be to own them too, as like we own the animals. So they became slaves, human-owned slaves. And so women were basically gradually also, their status was reduced. And by the time we had the first writings, and I used to teach college courses on the ancient first books, the oldest books like the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Iliad, the Odyssey, and these ancient books, you can just read in these ancient books how these kings are always going to war, they're eating a lot of meat. And of course, women are, by this time, just bought and sold like cows and sheep and goats, like they're just property, because animal agriculture reduces the sacred feminine dimension of life to being merely a breeder. So, whereas women were typically highly honored and respected, you know, in earlier times, in the pre-herding time, but once you had herding of animals, the status of women is just really dropped very far down, because now we own the female, we use her to give us more of what we want, more offspring and so forth. And boys also, unfortunately, are very wounded by this, because their natural sensitivity is reduced, because they're basically compelled to emulate the role model of a hard, tough, disconnected male to grow up to be someone who can harm animals, and, you know, brand them and kill them and so forth, and to fight with rival herders that dominate women and so forth. So this very macho sort of domineering male role model is required in any herding culture. And so what we know in our bones is the most sacred and most sensitive and most really essential dimension of our lives, which is women giving birth to babies and nursing those babies and protecting those babies, this is the foundation of a healthy life for any one of us. If we don't have that, we're not going to be physically healthy. We're definitely not going to be psychologically healthy. And as a society, we're not going to be healthy either psychologically and socially. If women don't have and are not supported in loving and nurturing and protecting and caring for in a loving way their children. But animal agriculture at its core is based on breaking the bond between the mother and her offspring. Mother cows, for example, I mean, I lived in an RV traveling around North America for 25, almost 25 years. And we, you know, very often we would park, not very often, but now and then we would park near a dairy. And I remember hearing in 3 o'clock in the morning, the calls, the cries, the bellowing and anguish of cows. You know, just almost like they were screaming because their babies had been stolen. This is what we do over and over again. We steal the babies from the mothers, mother pigs, mother cows, mother chickens, mother turkeys, mother sheep, goats. All these animals have their babies stolen and killed, and then they're impregnated again. So this routine and relentless destruction of the sacred bond between the mother and her offspring is a hideous and I think really demonic behavior on our part. And yet it's something that we all do, right? I mean, if I take out my wallet and pay for any meat or dairy product or eggs, I'm paying someone to do that. It's unavoidable. You have to do that. Whether it's a large factory farm or whether it's a little backyard operation, it's always the same thing. It's always, I own you. I own your baby. I'm going to steal your baby, kill your baby. I'm going to impregnate you again. I'm going to steal your baby again, kill your baby again. Then I'm going to kill you. On any animal operation, that is required. So the problem, I think, is that we have this beautiful dimension of our own true nature, which I refer to in the World Peace Diet as Sophia. And Sophia is the ancient Greek word that means wisdom, and it's feminine. And so Sophia, I think, refers to the sacred feminine wisdom, which is really celebrated in all the world's sacred traditions, that is within all of us, within women and within men. I think all of us, men and women, we all have the sacred feminine wisdom that yearns to love and nurture and protect life. The problem is, of course, is that we're all born into a society where from the time we're little kids, we have to sit around the table and eat the flesh and secretions of abused animals like I had to. I mean, I was none no different, you know, and I learned early on to shut down Sophia, you know, shut down this natural sensitivity and be capable of competition and violence against rival herders, you know, against other boys and against girls. And boys are taught to see girls as objects to be used sexually. You know, this is all part of the cultural program of animal agriculture. It's the use and abuse of other beings, as seeing them as instruments to be used. And we have an economic system that's based on the same basic principles. And so it really reinforces this idea of might makes right. You know, whoever is the most powerful, then you can take it. You know, you can, and we see this happening with this pandemic, like you were just saying, you know, those who have the most money make even more money. You know, those who have the most power make even more money, more power. Whenever you have a chaotic situation, you can get even more money and more control. And those who are vulnerable become even more vulnerable and get abused even more. And so this is animal agriculture in operation. Cows and pigs and chickens, we wouldn't have to tell them this. They know this. They're living among dominating human beings. They understand the situation. We have to realize that if we as human beings yearn for a world of joy and liberation and peace and harmony, it's absolutely available. This earth is beautiful. It's magnificent. It's abundant. We can easily feed everyone. We can easily all be healthy here and live in harmony together. There's nothing stopping us except one thing, and that is animal agriculture. If you're going to imprison animals for food, then that entails, it's a chain reaction. We have to become hard-hearted, dominate, exploit other beings, especially the sacred feminine, turn other beings into instruments. And when you do that for 10,000 years, right? Now we've done that for 10,000 years, and we have created a religion, basically, of science, of technocracy. We have a technocracy where it's based on a total domination of the entire planet at the expense of indigenous people, at the expense of ecosystems, at the expense of healthy air and water, and now wild free living animals. I mean, this is the truth, that 10,000 years ago, before animal agriculture, human beings, we were just 1% of the biomass on the land of the earth, right? We were our bodies weighed 1% at the most, and probably even less, but 1%, while free living animals were 99%. And now, just 10,000 years later, which is just a finger snap, just a short period of time, now we human beings and the animals that we own as property, cows and pigs and chickens and dogs and cats, we are now 98% of the biomass on Earth, and wild free living animals are only 2%. We've basically taken the Earth away from them and also from the healthy ecosystems that would support life. So this is going to create pandemics. I mean, this kind of exploitation and domination of nature and the massive oceans of pollution that come from animal agriculture. I mean, I've visited factory farms and slaughterhouses, and these places, there's literally so much toxicity that comes from animal agriculture. There's right now, according to again to the United Nations, who stu that study this, there's 20 we release every single day 27,000 tons of toxic chemicals into the earth. Our human society is releasing 27,000 tons of toxic chemicals into the air, into the water, onto the land in the form of herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, pollution. And we're eating all that, right? I mean, we're breathing it. And so are the free living animals. How are we going to avoid pandemics? You can't keep polluting the earth over and over and over again and eating that pollution and causing that pollution and concentrating that pollution. I mean, we were just at Hippocrates Health Institute in Florida, where people come to heal from disease by eating a very totally organic, raw diet of plant-based, of sprouts primarily, and vegetable juice. And it's wonderful to see people coming there and healing from cancer and from obesity and diabetes and many other diseases by purifying their diet and strengthening their immune system. And we can all do that. But I learned there of a study that whales and dolphins have been dying in off the coast of California, and they were wondering why they're dying and why they're doing kind of crazy things like beaching themselves sometimes. And they realized that it's because of all of the Prozac and other drugs that people are taking. They urinate all that out. It goes into the water, it goes into the oceans, and now these poor animals are suffering. There's a lot of fish suffering from birth control pills, the estrogen, all the estrogen. There's male fish in Europe that now are acting like female fish and having eggs and so forth from the birth control pills that people are taking. We're polluting the world in such an egregious way, and it's this mentality of animal agriculture. So again, I think hopefully this pandemic will be a wake-up call for us as individuals to take responsibility for our life, to move away from this blind adherence to a narrative of domination and exploitation of nature and animals and of the sacred feminine, and really work together to create healthy food systems and energy systems that are more local and more community-based, where we know our farmers, we grow our own food more, and support people who are growing organic, plant-based foods, and get our energy together, because we can no longer depend on these large systems that are so corrupt and full of disease and create so much toxicity. It's time for us to really take responsibility at a grassroots level to live our lives more in alignment with our values while we're on this earth.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, the problem, though, is, or one of the many problems, is that even vegetable agriculture is filled with toxic chemicals. I mean, it's not just the animal agriculture that is such a problem.
Well, yeah, that's
It's
true,
really
but
everything.
the thing is,
What
animals
about
concentrate toxins,
that time?
Okay, yeah.
I'm sorry. One thing I wanted to talk about before we run out of time, because I just know how quick time goes, is I want to talk about the community. Your book has really manifested from, since 2005, when this book first came out. There's really a community that's revolving around it and that's building. Can you share with my listeners how people are getting inspired to make these changes in their diet?
Yes, well, I think, you know, it's thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, the World Peace Diet is not just a book. I would say it's really a movement, just based on the underlying truth that I've been talking about, that all of us are wounded by being forced, you know, by very loving and well-meaning people to eat animal-based foods. And when we realize that and we see that we can be healthier and be part of the healing of our world on a very profound level by questioning the official narratives in our society, then we, you know, we find that this movement has really grown. The book has now been translated into, I think it's up to about 17 or 18 languages, all done by volunteers. So we travel all over the world, giving lectures, concerts. Also, I play the piano, but it's mainly the message and doing workshops and retreats and so forth on these ideas. And we have an online training program called the World Peace Diet Facilitator Training, where people who are interested in, after they read the World Peace Diet, they want to go just deeper into it. So I have, you know, videos and audio teachings and supplemental readings to just understand this at a deeper and deeper level. And then these people go on to very often to create films and or sanctuaries or movements. We have the like the Educated Choices program, which is now bringing this message of compassion and respect for animals to high school students all over the United States, and actually it's going worldwide now also. And so there's a fantastic sort of germination and spreading of this of these ideas through the media. Through social media or through grassroots networking, people creating veg fests in their community, for example, creating vegan sanctuaries or restaurants, creating like the pollen. One fellow went through our training and created what's called the Pollination Project. He has quite a bit of money. He's giving it, you know, he gives $1,000 away every day to people who are doing projects to help spread this message all over the world. So I think in the form of micro grants, you know, so I think the whole idea is that each one of us can make an effort to live our life for the short time we're on this earth. We're only here for a few decades anyway. So we're here for a few years. So while we're here, let's make an effort to understand what's happening and then to use our own unique talents and gifts and abilities in a way that we're part of the solution, whatever that is. If we're good at talking to people like you are, you know, spread the message that way. If we're good at, we love cooking food, or we love being creative through music or art. My wife's an artist. She paints paintings of animals, and or she has a cooking channel, you know. There's all kinds of things we can do, I think. You know, network, working with political in the political system, whatever it is that we feel drawn to, and just to support each other in doing that, to just get educated and to support other people in understanding these ideas better and in living them. Because I think what I'm talking about here, these are not just abstract intellectual concepts. We're talking about the survival of our society and of life on this planet as we know it right now. We're attacking the web of life really enthusiastically in a very diluted, harmful way now as human beings. And the latest pandemic is just another example. So the whole idea is this is a wake-up call, I think, for all of us to begin to reawaken Sophia within ourselves, the compassionate and joyful and creative dimension that loves and nurtures life, and to take this to the next level, basically, to really bring this message more and more to the whole world as best we can.
Yeah. Well, it's such a huge movement now. I mean, when I first became a vegetarian, I was not a vegan, but it was very hard to, you know, buy even tofu at a supermarket, you know,
let alone go
out to a restaurant. And now it's just a whole different thing. I mean, you know, I couldn't believe I was in Germany, in Berlin. There were more vegan restaurants there than in New York City, I think. I mean, it was great.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, we were in, you know, I could talk on and on about that, but we were in I guess it was about a year and a half ago in Athens, Greece. And they have just a burgeoning, this is one example, you know, vegan, where their veg fest went from like 5,000 to 10,000 to 15,000, you know, people every year. And we saw it happening all over Eastern Europe, in Warsaw, in so many different places in Budapest. China is incredible. The vegan movement is just exploding in China. There's actually, they have a whole vegan small city growing up in central China. It's all totally vegan agriculture. They're in Taiwan and all over Southeast Asia, of course, and North America. We're seeing it happening all over the world. So mm-hmm. I think it's really an idea whose time has come, like you're saying. When I first started this, no one even heard of it.
We have three vegan schools in Queens now.
Wow. That's amazing. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
well, see, that's it. That's it. You know, as kids, like you say, kids naturally are drawn toward plant-based foods, especially when they're prepared creatively and they're so delicious. And people, no kid wants to eat that horror and that terror that we're eating. So I think I wish I would have known, but I'm so glad my mother, who's now 91 years old, she's a vegan. You know, even though as a little kid, you know, she was preparing meat and dairy and she was saying that this is what everybody needs to eat. But my mother is a vegan. It was so neat. I was just visiting her. She's living now with my sister. My sister's was also a very strong meat eater, part of a fundamentalist Christian community. She's been a vegan now for 15 years, and so my mother and my sister, and then my sister's daughter is also now a vegan, and my sister's daughter has four children. They're all vegan from birth, so it's just really been so beautiful to see how. And when people understand this, and it just permeates and it just radiates out, it's just the best thing that we can possibly do for our loved ones and for our each other and for our world and for hungry people and for future generations,
right.
You know, and for slaughterhouse workers. I mean, for everyone, for ourselves, even if we don't care about anyone else.
On that note, Will, we are just about out of time, so mm-hmm. I just want to thank you and. You know, and thank you for your work and spreading the word. And, you know, just the last thing I want to say to people is, you know, vegan is really great, but you also want to eat healthy. I know that we've done things where people say, oh, these are vegan cupcakes, but, you know, they're artificially colored with sprinkles, et cetera.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
You want to eat a plant-based diet, but you want to eat a healthy diet as well.
Whole food, organic, absolutely. Plant-based. Yeah. And people can see me at worldpeacediet.com if they want to know more.
Yes, and I will put all those links up on my website. Everybody, thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful having you. Will, thank you so much. And everyone, have a great rest of the week. Stay safe. Keep that social distancing happening, but keep connecting with everyone online and however you can. Bye for now, and have a great rest of the week. Thank you, Will.
All right, so now I'm going to hit stop.
So,
and hopefully...
Yes, and I have to tell you, sometimes the...
Kaya Mania, Kaya Mania, Kaya Mania.